Welcome to the Independent Review. This is a weekly show summarizing the top stories and interviews from some of the leading independent journalists and media. Let's take a look at The Last American Vagabond with Ryan Christian and his interview with Dr. Peter McCullough.
The person in this position, like let's say you think you might be sick, should be doing, as opposed to go wait till you get extra sick and come back and let us know kind of a situation, you know, the way the hospitals are engaging with it.
The first update I have is to assess, is this the first, second, or third illness? If it's the first illness, then we think the full treatment measures like McCullough protocol are warranted. But if it's the second or third illness now, is characteristically mild. A recent paper by Chin and colleagues, New England Journal of Medicine, October of 2022, showed if it's the second or third infection, there's a negligible risk of hospitalization and death. And it doesn't matter if you took a vaccine or not. So the second or third infection is simply over-the-counter like any other cold. But the first infection, high-risk person, we do recommend virucidal nasal washes, dilute povidone iodine, dilute hydrogen peroxide, sprays, spray it up, sniff it back, spit it out. Got to kill the virus up in the nose. Can't rely on pills or IVs for that. Using oral nutraceuticals and supplements, zinc, vitamin D, vitamin C, quercetin, over-the-counter famotidine, over-the-counter aspirin. Then after that, we can use the oral antivirals, but they are largely de-emphasized now. Hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, Paxlovid, Molnupiravir. I think prednisone or steroids play a bigger role, colchicine, and then we're on to anticoagulants. Doctors can do this. There are established protocols. I mentioned the McCullough protocol, FLCC, and others. There are worldwide protocols, by the way, that use no ivermectin, no hydroxychloroquine, and they're perfectly fine.
Interesting. Well, so you mentioned the third illness. That's an interesting statement. Are you saying, so we're talking about people who got sick with COVID-19 and got sick again with COVID-19. Okay, so that's interesting. So do you think there's a factor in there? Well, I guess let me phrase it this way. If they're getting sick repeatedly, or do you know whether those are people that have already had an injection in that process? Or are you seeing people get repeatedly sick who never got an injection?
Well, most have taken the vaccines, don't forget, in the United States. The CDC says 87% of people took them. So being injected means almost everybody. And you're right, they are the people who are getting multiple infections. The unvaccinated, by the way, look terrific in every analysis, lowest risk of other illnesses, fit and strong. People who didn't take the vaccine, they didn't take it for a reason, and boy, is it showing up. They're looking great. But those who have taken the vaccine, they certainly can get it multiple times. The virus is mutating, it's becoming more mild. The current bivalent boosters now are already theoretically out of date. They were targeted in BA4, BA5. That's gone away now. It's now BQ1 and BQ1.1.
Interesting. Well, I'd like you to, if you could, elaborate on why you say that about the unvaccinated being better. But so just to find your point on that, I find this really fascinating. So do you think this is an immunity issue where, I guess, what is your opinion on natural immunity in regard to COVID-19? And then do you think it's the injection that's stopping that from being effective and that's why they're getting it repeatedly?
It's possible. I mean, don't forget, there's a lot of selection bias. Many people who didn't take the vaccines were younger, fitter, stronger. They already had COVID early on. So there's a lot of factors that could make them look better. We know in analyses from Canada, the UK, South Africa, Australia, the greater numbers of those hospitalized and dying, sadly, are those fully vaccinated. Now that's been reported in the United States, so seems to be universal. There are several papers, one by Wheatley and colleagues, 2021, that's notable, suggesting the more shots we take, the more the immune system is being taxed with this spike protein and less effective. It doesn't have the alacrity in order to fend off other infections. It may be explaining why we're seeing rises in respiratory syncytial virus, influenza, and others. It's clear taking genetic material coding for ancestral Wuhan spike protein has not helped the immune system at all. And these long-lasting injections certainly cause harm.
So in regard to the unvaccinated appearing to be more healthy, can you elaborate on that? Because I'm sure everyone's very interested in that, because that's a common point being made right now about the contrast. I mean, really, the people that are unvaccinated today are a control group in the world. So in your experience, can you elaborate on what you're seeing there?
Well, what we're seeing is they tend to be younger, fitter, with less medical problems. That's for sure. We do know that they, from a scientific perspective, they have the full cellular and mucosal immunity. Many have had the natural infection. So that means IgA and cellular immunity in the sinuses. It is a nose infection. People know that the swab has to go up in the nose. So we need the defenses there. The vaccines, a shot in the arm doesn't do anything for protection in the nose. There's papers by Chow, by Rimarisma, Acharian, Accorsi, all showing that COVID-19 vaccination does nothing for nasal protection against COVID-19.
That's interesting. You say that Dr. Bhakti has been really outspoken about this in general, really early in this conversation. And let me know if you agree with this in the broad sense, that he argues that most injections historically to this point aren't and can't be effective because they don't. He argues you can't essentially cause mucosal immunity by injecting something in the arm. How do you feel about that? That seems to throw into question all of these past vaccinations.
Right. I agree with that. I interviewed for my show, vaccine developer Hamid Merchant, who's someone who really promotes vaccines in the UK. And he said the only vaccines that provide any nasal mucosal immunity are the nasal mist vaccines. There's been a few flu mist vaccines. He said that would have been the only hope for COVID-19. So shots in the arm provide some systemic protection, let's say from polio or a serious, you know, intramuscular tetanus infection, but they don't provide any hope for protection in the nose or the nasopharynx. The pneumococcal vaccine, as an example, the 13-valent pneumococcal vaccine, it's published vaccine efficacy against pneumococcal hospitalization or death is 9%, statistically insignificant from zero. Same thing with influenza vaccine, paper by Chen and colleagues, MMWR in 2022. Current flu vaccine efficacy, 22%, statistically insignificant, 16%, statistically insignificant from zero. Remember, we need vaccine efficacy at least 50%, otherwise it's a no-go on these vaccines.
Yeah, well, so I guess the point would be that respiratory viruses, specifically a shot in the arm, is not, that's meaningless in regard to what would they
It's a poorly conceived idea from the very beginning. You know, I published that in August of 2020 in The Hill, in an op-ed that about the great gamble of the COVID-19 vaccine development program. It's a gamble. There's never been a shot in the arm that's ever stopped anything in the nose. Never happened.
And they know this. I mean, that's what Bhakti was saying all the way back then, that he's so upset and it changed his perspective of the entire field because he knew that they knew that and still promoted it. It's very interesting. You mentioned flu mist. That's an interesting overlap with, we see the strep A conversation rising right now. And there's a lot of very clear peer-reviewed science that shows at least the potential for that itself to increase the risk of strep A. Do you think there's an overlap there with the use of these flu mist and nasal flu sprays that were administered before that discussion rose up? Just your opinion?
We'd have to have data that, in fact, let's say a child received the flu mist vaccine and then got later on developed in that same child a group A strep infection, which, by the way, is easily treated with penicillin or amoxicillin. So group A strep is not a big deal. Mm-hmm. To see if there's a direct linkage. I think right now America's been spooked. So you hear a few cases about group A strep. I mean, come on, to do a strep test, and have somebody who's strep positive and treat them, that's an everyday occurrence in urgent care.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, I tend to personally feel it's a little more nefarious at some level because it's kind of trying to keep people in a state of fear. That's my personal opinion, but right. You're right. Ultimately, it's something that I do think there are average people that are just genuinely scared by what the hype and overreacting to. So in general, it's interesting that we see this discussion, and then let's talk about censorship. I want to ask you about the DNA part last. We've talked about briefly on AM Wake Up the other day in how this has been an evolving conversation around this that I think you pulled out of it a long time ago, in whether or not this is in fact actually either changing or integrating with your DNA, and then what that would actually mean going forward, you know, different than the things circulating in your bloodstream. So one, is that something you feel is absolute at this point, that this is changing your DNA? And then what would that really mean going forward in your perspective?
There's one paper, Alden and colleagues, senior author, Yang D. Marinus is the last author. The Swedish group did show integration of Pfizer, the code for Pfizer, into human DNA, a central reporting part called the amplicon. Almost certainly the entire code is installed. We know the spike protein is very close to the nucleus. I've shown that. Multiple studies have shown that. I showed that in my Substack recently. It doesn't matter if it's exactly in chromatin or in the nucleus. It's almost a certainty now that parent cells are transmitting the code for Pfizer and Moderna to daughter cells. Almost certainly that's happening, egg and sperm together in the embryo, and then in other tissues that are, you know, the cells are differentiating. This is disturbing. The fact that the genetic code does not get out of the human body. Roltgen and colleagues from Stanford showed in cell, the messenger RNA is not being digested and going away. It's permanently staying in lymph nodes.
Yeah, it's very, very alarming. And I'm sure a lot of people will be scared, but it's important to hear that so we understand. Actually, one more thing I wanted to get your take on is in regard to the blood discussion that's very prominent right now, right? And I think we did mention this again on AM Wake Up, but the idea of specifically the transfusion for that child and whether there's a risk there. And I mean, I personally think it's all but proven that there is the evidence of these things being in the blood, and that alone should be enough to at least question that. But do you feel that what do you think should be the step forward with the way that, with what's present in the blood and with blood transfusion specifically?
I think it's too late. I was a part of a group that warned the American Association of Clinical Blood Banking, the American Red Cross, early in 2021. We were concerned. They weren't asking about vaccination in blood donors. You know, it's water under the bridge at this point in time. The blood banking industry is a big industry. 87% of people have taken these vaccines. It's almost a certainty that the blood supply is changed. Fortunately, there are no severe proven reactions, vaccine-induced blood transfusion reactions where spike protein or messenger RNA has been implicated. But we'll certainly, you know, keep our eyes on that. I recognize it's a concern. It's a concern that doesn't have any practical solution.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And yeah, and I would agree that this is still being fleshed out, but there are potential cases that are being discussed as possibly being because of that, which, you know, I agree. You're right. We should always be wait for the evidence and the proof of something before we jump to conclusions. But it's very concerning to see that there's at least examples of people thinking it's already happened where a baby has died in this process. And now we have baby Will in New Zealand who just got forced to take that, the transfusion. And so it's an alarming reality where we know that there is high potential for problems and seemingly no concern there. I guess the last point on COVID-19 in general, or the vaccines related, is, you know, it's the way I even titled this today. As far as I'm concerned, this has been collapsed. The narrative has been exposed. It's obvious that there at some level is a willful ignorance in regard to the dangers of the injections. And yet it continues, right? Even more, not just continues, but now we see them pushing even harder over the top of it. The White House saying, well, you need to get this next shot. Like, one, I guess it's your opinion how to explain that. But I guess, two, what do we do in this situation, right? So I think it's clear that it's exposed, but it continues, right? What do you think?
I feel like I'm the last American vagabond wandering out there in the wilderness, you know, wondering what's happened to the world. The bivalent vaccines weren't even tested in humans. They failed in animals. The most recent dossier for pediatric vaccination with the bivalent boosters, the FDA only had it in their hands for 3 days. At this point in time, it's off the rails. Those promoting the vaccines have become unmoored. The vaccines are not safe for human use. They should be pulled off the market. We should give up this hopeful love affair that the vaccines were going to end the pandemic. They clearly have failed. We need to stop the mandates, stop the vaccines, begin vaccine injury research, and close out the pandemic.
Ryan is always doing great work. Be sure to check more of his stuff out at thelastamericanvagabond.com. Next, let's go to Scott from Rebunked News with this great solution-based episode.
So, we'll go back to just the teaching itself. And I'm sure you get this question all the time, but I've had a couple folks on too to talk about, you know, homeschooling, unschooling, and it's just, you know, it's the big question. It's really the big question. So, let's say I'm a, you know, husband, wife, mother, father, both have full-time jobs, you know, the public school system is the daycare, right? Like, that's basically, we send our kids to school because, you know, I don't have the means or capabilities to teach kids. Like, what would be your message to those parents that send their kids into the wolf's den every day because they don't feel like they have any other option?
Well, first, you do have options. And I know parents, I know single mothers of four children that homeschool. So, you know, if you think you have it tough, you should see some of the people I work with, but they manage to do it. And when you're in that situation, you just have to get a little bit creative. So what are your children doing during the day? Who are they with during the day? Can you get some relatives to maybe grandma, your grandparents on one side of the family, take the child on Monday, grandparents on the other side of the family, take them Tuesday. And you just get creative and mix it up. You could find a local co-op of homeschoolers and maybe your children are there on a Wednesday and you agree to take other people's children that Friday, right? Whereas you're getting other people involved, just a little bit of creativity. And the truth of the matter is you don't have to do the schooling between 8 a.m. And 3 p.m. You can do the schooling for the entire weekend. You can do schooling after school, typical school hours at nighttime or in the morning if you guys want to wake up early. So there are different ways to do it. But even if you send your children to public school, have no despair. That's okay. What you have to do is arm your children with the tools to identify the manipulation. So Cubs to Bears books is a good start. I would certainly recommend having your children take the course I teach using the Cubs to Bears children book series on propaganda, right? And then outside of school, you really want to make sure you do some additional unschooling. So what that looks like is your children are going to hate school over time because every child hates school, which tells you everything you need to know about, you know, the retarded system. I mean, imagine devising a system for children and all the children hate it. It's like, come on. So anyway, when your child, they're going to hate school. So then you say, but you're not going to hate what we do. So you identify their three primary interests and then you follow that interest and you guide that to teach them critical thinking, to develop skills, and to get them the entrepreneurial experience around what they're interested in. An example I like to give is photography because it's so straightforward. So you start, you have your child take a photography course, you get them a cool camera, you have them do fun assignments where they're taking photos of this or that. And then after they've been doing that for 5 or 6 months, Christmas time's coming up, you challenge them to start a basic seasonal Christmas photography, seasonal greetings cards business. And they do the marketing, they make the flyers, and you just start and you build from there and, you know, give them an education that will actually free them from, you know, the beast system.
Next, let's move to a great interview between two of the best journalists out there, Whitney Webb and James Corbett, discussing Elon Musk and the current Twitter situation.
To him rather recently, and I think, you know, it's pretty clear from how he handles himself on Twitter specifically, but in other regards as well, that he's very, very, very conscious of his public image, and there's a very specific public image of himself that he wants to construct. So maybe we could discuss that for a little bit, and if you would like to throw in some of the bits about his background that kind of clash with that public image a bit, sure. That would be helpful as well.
Well, I didn't go deeply into his family background and where he comes from, other than to point out that he is, again, as people hopefully know by now, literally the grandson of a card-carrying technocrat who was a high-up member of the Technocratic Party in Canada who fled to South Africa and apparently looms large in the Musk family lore. Essentially, he was an important figure, even though he died, I believe, when Musk was very, very young, perhaps even before he was born. But at any rate, he looms large in the Musk family legend. And then there's a whole story about his father and the abuse that he may have suffered at his father's hands. And now his father fathering new children with his stepdaughter. I don't know. It's very,
yeah,
very
weird stuff going on there. And that's
So this is the type of background, anyway, from which Musk emerged. But essentially, he emerged into the public spotlight at a relatively young age, making his way to Canada and then to the U.S., where he began a series of entrepreneurial ventures, starting with something called Zip2, which was meant to be a sort of, I guess, kind of like a proto-Craigslist, essentially list your business on the internet, when that was a new idea. And eventually managed to make some money out of that by essentially selling that service to newspapers that were starting to feel the pinch of classified ads, declining revenues, mm-hmm. and parlayed that straight into PayPal, which, again, is an entire story into itself. And I'm sure there's a lot to talk about with regards to the PayPal mafia and his connections to people like Peter Thiel. Mm-hmm. But don't worry, Peter Thiel has a totally different philosophy than Musk, at least that's what Musk assures us. So you don't have to worry about Palantir and things like that coming from Musk, no. You will simply worry about the brain chips and other things, because, of course, as people may or may not know, Elon Musk did spend a short time as CEO of the combined PayPal, what merged into PayPal from his X.com and Peter Thiel / Max Levkin's PayPal, eventually merged into a singular entity. Musk took over the CEO role for a short time, was eventually shoehorned out of there because the board was not happy with his decisions and the way he was trying to run the company. So he basically took the golden parachute out of there, received a few $100 million for his efforts, and parlayed that into SpaceX, Tesla Motors, and Solar City, and the Boring Company, and all of these other ventures, which I'm sure your listeners are broadly aware that he's been involved with. But of course, the connecting thread through all these ventures is government money, essentially.
Right.
A whole series of different ways in which government grants and tax breaks and what have you have essentially propped up his businesses to the point where they are possible at all. And I think it's starting to become a point. Now, you see, this is the interesting part of this, is because for a long time, Musk has been a darling of, I think, the good-thinking liberal left in the United States and elsewhere, who have seen him as this sort of cool space tech guy who is going to save the environment, and he cares about all the things we care about. It is only recently that he has made the heel turn, as it were, and is now being supported by the right wing of the culture war that's raging in the United States right now. And so he has enjoyed for a very long time this sort of glow of publicity of being some sort of essentially tech savior or tech guru. But now the very same types of platforms that would have been heralding him as a savior just a few years ago are now digging in and finding, you know, Tesla isn't a very well-run company and other such things. So it's just interesting to watch how this plays out, not based on any actual difference in what is happening on the ground, but simply in the change in people's perception of who this person is and whether he is on their side or not.
Right. So let's talk about a little bit how, specifically since he's purchased Twitter, how Elon Musk has been cultivating his image. So I think it's pretty clear that he's very interested in presenting himself, one, as anti-establishment right now. I mean, he's even gone so far to say things like, I might be suicided, and things of this nature. And this is a bit odd to me when you consider what you just mentioned. Of course, there's a lot of evidence for this, that his wealth, his current roster of companies, a lot of it could not exist without the establishment. And a lot of these companies are very, very much involved with the national security state, specifically SpaceX, which is a defense and intelligence contractor. So, you know, if this is a guy that's really going up against the, the establishment, the deep state, even though I don't really like that term, I prefer national security state. He's essentially a part of that. So it's a bit, there's definitely a contrast there. He's trying to, you know, I guess make himself seem just like a regular person, on occasion posting memes and other things. And, you know, there's other aspects to this image he's building. What sort of image do you see him building, and what sort of motives do you think may be behind that?
It's extremely difficult to know sort of the inner workings of the creation, the public creation of a spectacle like Elon Musk. But I do see it as somewhat similar to what we saw just a few years ago with the creation of the personality of Donald Trump, and being sold to a certain section of the public that I think is certainly ready for some sort of savior. I think that it is the savior narrative that is being played on here. And we saw that with Trump was going to be the savior of people on the right, again, of this culture war divide that's taking place certainly in the United States right now. And then that was, if not eclipsed, perhaps bolstered by the QAnon psyop, which even fed further into that idea of the savior narrative. And that obviously didn't quite pan out the way that Q supporters were hoping. So now it's time to find a new person to pin hopes on. And Musk has taken up that mantle. And to obviously, as you say, I think Musk is extremely aware of his public image. And just the fact that he is engaged in tweeting and replying to people on Twitter on a hourly basis shows that he is interested in at least cultivating some sort of public image of himself. And clearly that is lining up with the type of, I suppose broadly, the resistance movement that has risen up in the past few years against lockdowns and mandates of various sorts. And Musk has positioned himself to be, I'm going to move to Texas because I don't want to deal with California and its draconian lockdown laws and all of this. So he has positioned himself in this way for a couple of years now, at least, and now is really coming out as someone who is being championed essentially largely by people on the right who are disaffected by the establishment. And I think this whole narrative of the Twitter files plays perfectly and brilliantly into that, because clearly Twitter was very much being run by people who were very, very invested in the Democrat Party and basically ensuring the continued rule of the Democrats and a disproportionate suppression of information coming from the right side of the political spectrum. So Musk being put in this position, well, he's the opposition to that. Therefore, he's on, quote unquote, our side. And I think exactly as Trump, the billionaire, was posited as, don't worry, guys, he's on your side. He's for the average working man. I think, again, Musk is stepping into that role now that Trump has seemed to have vacated.
So what Musk is doing here has sort of raised my eyebrow about in terms of, you know, what he might be up to. So one thing that I've noticed over the past 2 years, especially, you know, if you look at, for example, everyone these days knows about the World Economic Forum, right? So one of their big themes last year was rebuilding trust. And a lot of, even the Biden administration, a lot of, you know, prominent institutions are very much aware that there is a major lack of trust, specifically among certain segments of the population. So, you know, if I was the World Economic Forum, which again, Elon Musk was a young global leader, right? And agrees with a lot of the main policies that, you know, sort of WEF-centric politicians and others tend to support, like UBI, among several others, I think a carbon tax, some other things. You know, if I was, you know, someone like Klaus Schwab, I guess, right? And I wanted to get people to rebuild trust, and I know they're never going to trust me, right? I need some sort of figure that people who hate me will trust that supports the same policy agendas that I do, right?
Exactly right. Essentially influence laundering by way of the cool new tech savior that, hey guys, he's totally on your side. And I definitely see what you're saying there. And again, since this is 2022, I guess that we have to connect everything back to the World Economic Forum. So we must mention young global leader Elon Musk. Clearly, and as you say, on board with so many different aspects of the technocratic agenda generally, but the World Economic Forum agenda specifically in Klaus Schwab's statements. I know there's been a Twitter meme that's floated around for some time comparing Klaus Schwab's statements on various issues like UBI and brain chips and what have you, and Elon Musk's statements. I did make a little segment of that in my recent Elon Musk technocratic huckster expose, just to drive home the point that I think these people are aligned on many fundamental issues. So where is this break, and why are people suddenly cheering on this person who has been so intimately affiliated with the World Government Summit and the World Economic Forum and all of these institutions?
And where's New World Order on his clothes and stuff?
Exactly right. Yeah. Very, very strange symbolism and things that come from himself and from Grimes and the various people that he's been associated with. But also, I mean, perhaps more substantially, we're looking at someone who is literally in the process of creating brain chips that are going to augment humans in order to save us from the transhuman nightmare that's coming somehow. Don't think too deeply about that. And oh, by the way, they're killing, you know, the test animal subjects left and right, but I'm sure it'll all be sorted out.
Yeah, like 20% of the animal subjects die. And if this was any normal medical device and the FDA was functioning as it was before COVID, it would be very hard to get it to human trials. But let's just say it seems like Elon Musk is taking advantage of the removal of obstacles at the FDA since the COVID situation to get Neuralink straight to human trials after animal trials killed like 15 out of 23 animals, or 8, depending on if you believe Elon Musk's company.
Right.
Directly. Yeah. They say it was 8, not 15, but, and, you know.
Exactly right. And let's put this in perspective for people. What is the ultimate agenda here? I think your audience is not naive, and I think they understand by this point that when something is part of a broader agenda, it will be approved through the official regulatory process, exactly as the mRNA vaccines were approved. Well, I mean, there's a whole thing about the word approved, but you understand, emergency use authorized. And exactly in this case as well, the things that Neuralink are have been doing and was documented before all of this Twitter files hype started to swell up in the media, absolutely, as you say, would have disqualified absolutely any other company. But for some reason, on this particular project, it seems that the regulatory agencies don't seem to care too much about the, let alone the animal subjects, but how about the potential for human trials going forward? Again, if it's part of an agenda item, I think the doors will be opened for it. And this is a prime example of that.
Thanks for tuning in to the first episode of the Independent Review. Make sure to check all of the links below for each video and their respective websites. Tune in next Friday night for the highlights of the week. See you soon.